So maybe you notice the weather is changing. Did anyone notice any kind of sadness or response to appearance of clouds? A little bit? Yeah. It's so nice when we see sunshine. So this afternoon I wanted to speak a little bit about what we call right view. So the Eightfold Noble Path is one framework for viewing the journey, the spiritual journey. And I was mentioning to one of the discussion groups the division of Sila, Samadhi, Panya. It's the development of ethical conduct, harmonious living, concentration, and wisdom. So we're really practicing to grow wisdom, to uproot ignorance. So we undertake a practice of non-harming in our lives. And the five precepts are often described as simply different aspects of non-harming. So undertaking the training to refrain from harming living beings. Undertaking the training to refrain from taking what is not given. Undertaking the training to be aware of our sexual energy and to respect our own and others' relationships. Undertaking the training to be aware of speech and avoid speech that is false, idle, or harsh. So there's more, a little bit more about speech, but just recognizing the energy in speech for good and for harm. And the fifth precept in this grouping is around intoxicants. And again, these are all trainings. They're not absolutes, they're trainings. So I undertake the training to refrain from intoxicants which cloud the mind and cause heedlessness. So, I mean, a whole retreat, we could focus simply on the precepts and the impeccability with which we can attend to living out these precepts in our lives. Not just as trainings to avoid causing harm, but actually as invitations to support the thriving of living beings, to develop restraint and generosity, and to practice speech which is appreciative, encouraging, and helpful. So the precepts and these guidelines are really at the foundation of our practice, because it is with a mind undisturbed by regret, undisturbed by remorse, that we can actually take our seat in meditation. One of my teachers, Joseph, after years of practice, had a memory come up from when he was 16 and how he had turned down the invitation to a classmate's sweet 16 birthday party. And he just had this poignant moment of regret of having seen her disappointment and her feeling of sadness and hurt when he refused the invitation in a somewhat callous, careless way. So interesting to think about how our practice actually, over the years of practice, there will be, you know, a kind of purification that takes place where, oh, I did that. I caused harm. And not necessarily being able to make amends, but recognizing the interwoven nature of our lives. So this fundamental piece of non-harming gives us the stability and the steadiness to begin and to continue our practice. So, right view is actually part of the wisdom collection on the Eightfold Noble Path, but also considered as really the initial and guiding piece of practice. And what is right view? Well, I think it's an ongoing discovery for me about right view, but it's this discovery that we make in our practice about the conditioned nature of experience. Well, we spoke a bit about conditions this morning and all the factors that came into play for us to be here, for us to hold the retreat and receive these teachings. But there's also the conditioned nature of our own body, mind. So this right view is recognizing that not only are we subject to change and a product of multiple conditions, but likewise everything around us. And so right view is this willingness to hold the relative view. We have names, we have histories, we have experiences, we have talents and interests and projects and plans, and we have an identity. Yes, we have an identity. I do this, I like this, I go here, I go there. But at the same time, in this spaciousness of understanding the conditioned nature of all phenomena, we recognize that as soon as I solidify my identity around any aspect, such as my love of cycling or my ability to speak French, whatever it is, as soon as I identify and solidify around that, I set myself up for great suffering. And we see this, you know, in our own lives and in those around us, because we are of the nature to change. Our bodies grow old. You know, when my dad had to give up driving, it was like, wait a second, what's going on? It was one of the great pleasures of his life. Slide himself into his sports car, turn the engine, and boom, off he would go. He loved it. And the idea that someone else would take him for a drive, what? What was the point of that? So it's this amazing conundrum and paradox. Can we hold this relative view of ourselves as having an identity within the absolute view that everything is in flux, everything is changing? So this week I was at École Victor Brodeur in Esquimalt, teaching La Pleine Conscience, mindfulness, in French. So this was a bit of a challenge for me, but at one point, after doing a listening meditation with the bell, one boy said, "À quoi ça sert? What's the point?" You know, and he was just very honest about, he thought it was useless. Why would we bother to pay attention? Why would we bother to pay attention to the sound or the breath or the body or anything? And I thought, okay, he's got a point there. Why? What is it? How can I explain it to him in a way that is meaningful? And I think for each of us, we're finding out, why am I doing this practice? You know, we may have been brought to practice by the encouragement of a friend or maybe we've read something, we just have this intuition that this very simple, deceptively simple practice of sitting down and observing our own experience, that this might have a tremendous impact on our own happiness, our own well-being, and our ability to navigate the uncertainty, the unpredictable nature of living a human life. So we've had this little intuition, and we're continuing to water the seeds of that intuition. And so with this young man, I said, basically, we're doing this to learn what's happening, to see clearly, and to free ourselves from habits, the habits of mind that don't serve us. Habits of attachment, habits of aversion, habits of dissociation, checking out. So this word, we get caught. And I think it's such a good word to say we get caught, because we do, we get ensnared, we get entangled. And it can be very uncomfortable and difficult to free ourselves from obsessive worry, entangled thoughts about what we should have done, could have done, what we might do, could do. So the mind is always, in a sense, it's trying to land in terms of finding where it can solidify in terms of a self. So I think about right view, and how one way to think about right view is the frameworks by which we live our lives. So one framework, very familiar in the West, is the framework of accomplishment. Well, by the time I'm 23, I'll have written one masterpiece, at least. And, when I was a kid, a group of friends and I, we made our predictions. I'm going to learn Russian. I'm going to go skydiving. I'm going to, whatever it was. And one friend, actually, she did do some skydiving, but it was just to get it done, It was on her list, and so she got it done. So accomplishment can be a driving force in the lives of so many people. And how often do we stop and think, well, why? What is the goal? What is the reason that I need to accomplish in this domain or that domain? So, and then another framework, of course, is sense pleasure and sense experience. How many people do we know who have a bucket list of beautiful places they want to visit? I mean, who invented that idea of the bucket list? I mean, it's like, oh, I'm going to go skiing, and I'm going to climb to the base camp at Mount Everest, and hiking in volcanoes, and wonderful to have great experiences. It's not to deny the value of that, but to think about how sense experience is simply another temporary engagement, another temporary way of engaging in our lives, and not necessarily a way to build an identity. So in both of these cases, the project, the accomplishment, and sense pleasure, the sense of self becomes entangled. And it's very poignant because, I overheard someone saying, they didn't know if their trip to Italy was going to come off. Well, and someone on the radio who missed his $5,000 cruise because Air Canada didn't get him there in time. I mean, a lot of identity is formed around our projects to acquire more sense experience or accomplish more. So the Buddha on the night of his awakening, and this is a beautiful story, just this glimpse of the mind of a fully awakened being. On the night of his awakening, sitting down under the Bodhi tree, he saw how beings perpetuate the cycles of birth by constantly grasping after the pleasant and trying to avoid the unpleasant, or by simply floating along in a fog of confusion. And in a very short paragraph, there is this description of him reviewing his own previous lives. I saw that I was born in such a place, with such a name, and such an experience of pleasure and pain. And passing away from there, I was born in such a place, with such a name and such an experience of pleasure and pain. Manifold past lives appearing in his consciousness, recognizing that the driving force was this desire for becoming, this desire for sense pleasure, accomplishment, this desire to be someone in the world. And so he saw this round of birth, this cycle of samsara, as inevitably being entwined with a great deal of suffering. And he saw and understood the noble truth that yes, there is suffering, and the source of suffering is this grasping, this greed, this hunger for experience, tanha. But he also saw that there was an end to suffering. And the end to suffering is this path of practice. And we're experiencing it today. I mean, what's interesting to me is that on a sunny day in rainy Victoria, you all chose to come to a retreat where you would mostly be inside and sitting. And that speaks to me of our collective interest in freeing our minds from the entanglement of the me project. So we want to live with more equanimity. We want to be more spacious. We want to be less reactive. We want to bring our compassion, our service, our kindness to others. And this is worthy of being acknowledged and honored in ourselves and our Sangha, that there is this. I mean, I think we have maybe 800 people on our mailing list in Victoria now, and our retreats are serving a need in the community to support each of us in our path of freeing the mind. So, right view reminds us of the dangers inherent in any kind of identification. The great way is not difficult for one who has no preferences. So this great way that we're on is, I think, a process of self-understanding, of building this confidence in ourselves, and developing this beautiful factor of equanimity. So equanimity, it is considered one of the factors of awakening. And these factors of awakening apparently they are arising in the mind in a cluster. So it's interesting to think about that, how these mental factors of equanimity and confidence and faith, they arise in a cluster in the mind. But the Buddha was able to actually separate them out and see what their constituents were. So here are a few of these factors. Every wholesome mind state has faith in it or confidence. It's so interesting to think of that. So a wholesome mental state like compassion is actually contains this spark of faith or confidence, this knowing that our action, our trembling towards before the suffering of others actually can make a difference. So this beautiful quality of faith. And then mindfulness, of course, this being present. Self-respect, non-greed, non-hatred, and pliancy of mind. So when I came to that one, I was thinking, yes, pliancy of mind. So the ability to be flexible, to move with changing conditions. This adaptability and buoyancy that comes from our practice. So, as a factor of awakening, upekkha or equanimity has the character of evenness. So this is interesting, this word evenness. And it manifests as unshakable balance of mind. Unshakable balance of mind. And there is a discourse in which the Buddha counsels the monks on how to respond to speech which is harsh, derisive, blaming, mocking. And basically, he's counseling them to be unshakable, non-reactive, and to withstand these verbal assaults without retaliating, without becoming agitated. So equanimity serves to prevent any deficiency or excess in the other mental factors. So again, it has this balancing energy. And so one of the reasons why today I was inviting you to be continuous in your mindfulness and aware of transitions and noticing stepping out and temperature and letting our awareness go with us through the day is that it is through continuity of mindfulness that we develop concentration. And equanimity arises out of concentration. And so, just examining this a little more closely, concentration secludes the mind. There's a bit of seclusion happening, even in a short day of practice like this. And so we're secluded not just from distraction, but from the hindrances. So, as our momentum in practice builds, we see that where we would in the past have been caught by a thought of desire, like, oh, maybe I'll stop and get something to eat on the way home. Well, that would be kind of nice. Maybe I'll go to, you know, those kinds of thoughts. Where we might have been caught in the planning of our next pleasant experience, the momentum of practice that we've been developing here today actually creates a sort of sense of seclusion, and that concentration is allowing us to be more spacious. Maybe I will, or maybe I won't. You know, there isn't that drive to follow through on all our impulses. So, it is this stability of mind, this clear seeing that arises from continuity of practice, from the development of equanimity. And we begin actually to see how we might practice. And meditation teachers who love to create lists in imitation of the Buddha. Gil Fronsdahl, a teacher in California, he came up with some interesting lists, an interesting list, 7 supports for equanimity. So I'll just go through these and see if there's any that resonate with you. And there may be 1 or 2 which you might actually begin to put into practice. In a more deliberate way. So he says one of the supports for equanimity is integrity. And I think this is such a beautiful example of how our practice of ethical conduct supports our practice of mindfulness. Because when we know we have acted with integrity, whatever is thrown at us in terms of accusations of improper behavior or having said the wrong thing or done the wrong thing, we can be unshakable in our knowledge that we have acted with integrity. So the ancient Buddhist texts speak of being able to go into any assembly of people and feel blameless. And the second one of these supports is faith. So, and here Gil refers specifically to our faith and the confidence that we have in our practice. And I think that, you know, over a lifetime, whenever we've begun the spiritual journey, we will no doubt encounter doubt. We may be pulled in another direction. We may feel that our practice isn't actually manifesting in terms of more spaciousness. But if there is even the smallest amount of faith, if we have tasted any inner spaciousness, any freedom of mind, then it's likely that we will return to practice and we will have more equanimity in the face of obstacles that arise. Mental, emotional, physical, circumstantial. And then the third support is a well-developed mind. So, and I think this is such an interesting expression because we think about physical fitness and going to the gym. And when I was with these high school students, I said to them, is there anyone that you admire? A sports figure? A musician? Someone in your family? So just, I invited them to just close their eyes and think about that for a moment. And then after a moment, this one woman raised her hand and she was thinking of a particular musician. She wouldn't tell us which one, but she did say it was someone who played guitar. And so I said, well, just think about the years of practice, of paying attention and developing the skill of being a musician. And someone else said that there was actually someone in her family whom she admired very much for her kindness. That was a beautiful example. And kindness is, of course, like any of the wholesome mental qualities, is a practice, like generosity. You know, at first it may be difficult to give. And many teachers will say, if you have an impulse to give, do not pass over that impulse, but honor it and strengthen this beautiful quality in the mind of generosity. So a well-developed mind is a mind that is nurturing and developing wholesome qualities like resolve and patience, kindness, truthfulness. So another support, according to Gil Fronsdal, is well-being. And I really appreciate him including this because, again, you know, those Buddhists, we get a bad rap for being all about the suffering. So well-being, taking in the good, allowing ourselves to appreciate the blossoms, the new leaves, the signs of spring. So really, I think well-being is really important, and caring for ourselves, basically, every day. And sometimes it's interesting how the word dukkha, suffering, one aspect of dukkha is the relentlessness of having to care for the human body. And it's true. And my mother and I, you know, when we sit down for dinner, I'll say, here we are again. And she'll say, yes, it's endless. You know, just feeding ourselves, you know, groceries and shopping and preparing. Well, it all depends on how you look at it. I had a friend in Massachusetts who worked at the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center. His name was Posh. And he told me once, he said, Margo, I love thinking about food. I love going out to buy food. I love preparing meals, and I love sitting down to eat them. He no bones about it, you know? He just recognized that as a source of pleasure in his life. So well-being, taking in the good, and recognizing that those are actually, those beneficial experiences strengthen our hearts and allow us to meet the challenges in life. And so another support is wisdom. And wisdom is the application of so many different experiences of understanding that come as insights, as glimmers, intuitions. So wisdom might be understanding that a person's actions are not who they are fundamentally. So wisdom might be understanding that it would be skillful and a way of taking care of myself to limit my engagements, to limit my activities, and make sure there's more space and simplicity in my life. So applying our wisdom. And so Gil Fronsdal says, one of the most powerful ways to use wisdom to strengthen and facilitate equanimity is to be mindful of when equanimity is absent. So that's bringing our mindfulness and noticing, oh, I'm being reactive. Oh, you know, I'm kind of angry. What's going on? So there's like this alarm button. Equanimity is absent. and recognizing that I can bring some compassion to the situation. I can bring some care to myself and to others. So then there's insight, and this practice, we call it insight meditation. And it's really, you know, one translation of the word vipassana, which means seeing into. So that's what we're doing. We're growing wisdom to see clearly, to free ourselves from habit patterns, getting caught, entanglements. And in terms of insight, one of the insights that we all have had, even today, is this recognition of impermanence. And this beautiful phrase from Steve, you know, this is the way it is for me for now. Just tacking on that little expression, for now. It's like remembering things are in flux, things are changing. And I was coming here this morning, just noticing the light, noticing someone standing with a camera, noticing trees, noticing cars in motion, and this awareness of the flow of my experience, that there's really no way to avoid this river, this journey of life. We want to be in our lives, we want to live our lives, but we need also to recognize and let this insight into impermanence help us to strengthen equanimity. And I was saying at lunchtime to Metta and Louise about trust, you know, trusting our intention. And I said it to you as well, Jack, and the group who were there. It's trusting ourselves that as we deepen our understanding, as we grow our equanimity, we actually will be able to respond skillfully in our lives. Trusting ourselves to meet this flow of experience, this journey of life. In the deepest forms of insight, we see that things change so quickly that we can't hold on to anything. And eventually, the mind lets go of clinging. Letting go brings equanimity, and the greater the letting go, the deeper the equanimity. And I often think of this beautiful phrase, may I do everything with a mind that lets go. So, whatever I'm doing, whether it's some creative endeavor, whether it's attempting to repair a rift in my family, whether it's helping an elder, whether it's organizing something. So this being willing to be present and fully there, but letting go of results. Because really, we don't know. We only have control over our own contribution to any set of conditions. So then the last support of the seven that Gil lists here is freedom. So freedom comes when we begin to let go of our reactive tendencies. And it's like that poem I read earlier. We can get a taste of what this means by noticing areas in which we were once reactive but are no longer so. So there may have been things that upset us when we were teenagers. Maybe they're no longer so prominent in our minds. So we work to expand the range of life experiences in which we are free. And I think in recent years, I've been practicing quite a bit with Steve Armstrong, who is a student of Utejaniya. And I think that this, and his practice emphasizes noticing the attitude of mind, really becoming aware of what is present in the mind, because that shapes and colors all our perception and everything we say and do. So recently I was in a classroom, and it was the Tuesday morning after the long weekend. And I was introducing the children to mindfulness, and I noticed they were very subdued. And I thought, I wonder what's going on. I thought maybe their teacher has threatened them or somehow that they had to behave and listen and not move an inch. But she seemed really nice. She didn't seem like that kind of teacher. And, you know, there was one or two who participated. I told them a story. The morning was okay. It was just seemed a little bit, not something was just, I was missing something. And as I was leaving, she said, I hope you don't mind, but they're a bit quiet because they've just had 4 days off. And of course, if you're a kid, coming back to school after Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and a Monday, and no school, whoa, it's not easy. You have to sit still. You have to sit at a desk. You have to listen. So they had, their pass out of jail had expired. And I hadn't clued into that context. Luckily, though, I had a chance to go to another class. And it was over at George Jay, and the teacher had written in her notes to the art gallery, a pretty rowdy bunch. That was her view of her students. And they came in after recess, and they were moving around. And so the first thing I said to them was, tell me something you really enjoyed doing over this long 4-day weekend. They were quiet for a moment, and then one girl said, I gave my dad a hug because he was looking kind of sad. It was so nice. And so I said, tell me about that. Well, I hugged him, and I just kind of hugged him. And then another boy said, we won our hockey game 11-4, and we had no goalie. We had no goalie and no equipment for a goalie, so the net was empty, and still we won. And then another boy, he put up his hand, he said, I had a soccer game, and I scored my first goal. I said, how did that feel? Exciting. And you could just see him reliving the pleasure of that experience. And then another boy said, I turned a backflip on the trampoline. And they shared their experiences. And meanwhile, their teacher was going around the room and kind of, oh, don't talk too loudly. She was kind of trying to control what was happening in the room. And it was kind of sad to me that she wasn't kind of tuning in to what was happening. She was still trying to exert some control. And I found myself wanting her to be different than she was, instead of recognizing that due to conditions, maybe having a pretty rowdy bunch, she was always trying to put out fires. But anyway, the group came to the gallery, and so my program is that I visit the classroom, then they come to the art gallery a couple of days later, and we do mindfulness at the art gallery with listening, with movement, with music, and story. And they were really great, and they participated. And I think she relaxed a bit. But just as an example of how this practice of seeing the mind, seeing what the filter is, seeing even subtle forms of desire, wishing that she could open up, wishing that she could be different, that impedes my equanimity with the way things are. So, and of course, there's self-forgiveness. You know, equanimity is also being gentle with ourselves and knowing we did the best we could, given the circumstances, given the conditions. And our parents, they did the best they could, given the conditions, given the circumstances. And in fact, something that you said at lunch, Metta, you know, my mother grew up during the war. Many of our parents did grow up during the war. And there's no doubt that that has an impact on the nervous system, which, you know, has an impact on all those with whom an individual comes in contact. So I think about how, you know, this practice of equanimity is actually quite contagious. And beautiful stories are told about the one individual whose calm demeanor, whose ability to hold the space and mindfully respond and do what is needed, actually inspires others and motivates others to find their own resources to be non-reactive, to be of service, and to aid instead of adding fuel to difficult situations. So this is the Buddha on equanimity. As a solid mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise and blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. And the Buddha's instruction to his son, Rahula. Rahula, develop meditation that is like the earth, for then agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind. Just as when people throw what is clean and unclean on the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind when you develop meditation like the earth. So let's just sit for a moment. So whereas in the morning we might have been ruffled or disturbed by sounds and noises in the room, perhaps at this point in the day we just notice sounds arising, each with their own texture, duration. So letting the words and the images, the stories, the anecdotes, all just settle in or fade from memory, taking what is useful, what seems relevant and helpful, and leaving the rest. So may our practice ripple out in all directions. May we continue to deepen and grow this heart. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so we become clear upon hearing these words of the Dharma. So thank you for listening. Thank you for your attention. So now I invite you to step outside into the changing light. See what you notice. And we'll come back at about 5 to 4. And we'll wrap up by about 4:15.